Death of an Expert Witness, Disc 4.
Chapter 5. The house was an excellent example of late 17th century domestic architecture. A three-story brick mansion with a hipped roof and four dormer windows, the centre three-bay projection surmounted by a pediment with a richly carved cornice and medallions. A flight of four wide, curved stone steps led to the doorway, imposing on its pilasters, but solidly, unostentatiously right. Dalgliesh paused momentarily to study the facade. Haworth said, "Agreeable, isn't it? But wait till you see what the old man did to some of the interior." The front door, with its elegant but restrained brass door handle and knocker, was fitted with two security locks, a Chubb and an Ingersoll, in addition to the Yale. At a superficial glance, there was no sign of forcing. It was opened almost before Haworth had lifted his hand to ring. The man who stood aside, unsmiling, for them to enter, although not in uniform, was immediately recognisable to Dalgliesh as a police officer. Howard introduced him briefly as Inspector Blakelock, Assistant Police Liaison Officer. He added, "All three locks were in order when Blakelock arrived this morning. The Chubb connects the electronic warning system to Guy's Mast Police Station. The internal protection system is controlled from a panel in the Police Liaison Officer's room." Dalgliesh turned to Blakelock. "And that was in order?"
"Yes, sir."
"There is no other exit?"
It was Haworth who answered. "No. My predecessor had the back door and one side door permanently barred. It was too complicated coping with a system of security locks for three doors. Everyone comes in and goes out by the front."
"Except possibly one person last night," thought Dalgliesh. They passed through the entrance hall, which ran almost the whole length of the house, their feet suddenly loud on the marble, tessellated floor. Dalgliesh was used to receiving impressions at a glance. The party did not pause on their way to the stairs, but he had a clear impression of the room, the high moulded ceiling, the two elegant pedimented doors to right and left, an oil painting of the laboratory founder on the right-hand wall, the gleaming wood of the reception counter at the rear. A police officer with a sheaf of papers before him was using the desk telephone, presumably still checking alibis. He went on with his conversation without glancing up. The staircase was remarkable. The balustrades were carved oak panels, decorated with scrolls of acanthus foliage, each newel surmounted by a heavy oak pineapple. There was no carpet, and the unpolished wood was heavily scarred. Dr. Kerrison and Superintendent Mercer mounted behind Dalgliesh in silence. Haworth, leading the way, seemed to feel the need to talk. "The ground floor is occupied with the reception and the exhibit store. My office, my secretary's room, the general office, and the police liaison officer's room. That's all, apart from the domestic quarters at the rear. Chief Inspector Martin is the chief PLO, but he's in the USA at the moment. We only have Blakelock on duty. On this floor, we have biology at the back, criminalistics at the front, and the instrument section at the end of the corridor. But I put a plan of the lab in my office for you. I thought you might like to take that over, if it's convenient. But I haven't moved any of my things until you've examined the room. This is the biology lab." He glanced at Superintendent Mercer, who took the key from his pocket and unlocked the door. It was a long room. The ceiling carvings had been removed, perhaps because Colonel Hoggett had thought them inappropriate to a working laboratory. But the scars of the desecration remained. The original windows had been replaced by two long windows, occupying almost the whole of the end wall. There was a range of benches and sinks under the windows, and two islands of workbenches in the middle of the room, one fitted with sinks, the other with a number of microscopes. To the left was a small glass-partitioned office, to the right a dark room. Beside the door was an immense refrigerator. But the most bizarre objects in the room were a pair of unclothed window dressers' dummies, one male and one female, standing between the windows. They were unclothed and denuded of their wigs. The pose of the bald, egg-shaped heads, the jointed arms stiffly flexed in a parody of benediction, the staring eyes and curved arrow-like lips gave them a hieratic look of a couple of painted deities. And at their feet, a white-clad sacrificial victim, was the body. Howarth stared at the two dummies as if he had never seen them before. He seemed to think that they required explanation. For the first time, he had lost some of his assurance. He said, "That's Liz and Burton. The staff dressed them in a suspect's clothes so that they can match up bloodstains or slashes." He added, "Do you want me here?" "For the moment, yes," answered Dalgleish. He knelt by the body. Kerrison moved to stand beside him. Howarth and Mercer stayed, one each side of the door. After 2 minutes, Dalgleish said, "Cause of death obvious. It looks as if he was struck by a single blow and died where he fell. There's surprisingly little bleeding." Kerrison said, "That's not unusual. As you know, you can get serious intracranial injury from a simple fracture, particularly if there's extradural or subdural hemorrhage, or actual laceration of the brain substance. I agree that he was probably killed by a single blow, and that wooden mallet on the table seems the likely weapon. But Blaine Thompson will be able to tell you more when he gets him on the table. He'll be doing the PM this afternoon." "Reiger is almost complete. What sort of estimate did you make of the time of death?" "I saw him just before 9, and I thought then that he'd been dead about 12 hours, perhaps a little longer. Say between 8 and 9 PM. The window is closed and the temperature pretty steady at 65 Fahrenheit. I usually estimate a fall in body temperature in these circumstances of about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit an hour. I took it when I examined the body, and taken with the Reiger, which was almost fully established then, I'd say it was unlikely that he was alive much after 9 PM. But you know how unreliable these estimates can be. Better say between 8:30 and midnight." Howarth said from the door, "His father says that Lorimer rang him at 9:15. I went to see the old man this morning with Angela Foley to break the news to him. She's my secretary. Lorimer was her cousin. But you'll be seeing the old man, of course. He seemed pretty confident about the time." Dalgleish said to Kerrison, "It looks as if the blood flowed fairly steadily, but without any preliminary splashing. Would you expect the assailant to be blood-stained?" "Not necessarily, particularly if I'm right about the mallet being the weapon. It was probably a single, swinging blow, delivered when Lorimer had turned his back. The fact that the murderer struck above the left ear doesn't seem particularly significant. He could have been left-handed, but there's no reason to suppose he was. And it wouldn't have required particular force. A child could probably have done it." Kerrison hesitated, disconcerted. "Well, a woman, certainly." There was one question that Dalgleish had formally to ask, although from the position of the body and the flow of the blood, the answer was in little doubt. "Did he die almost immediately, or is there any possibility that he could have walked about for a time, even locked the door and set the alarms?" "That's not altogether unknown, of course, but in this case I'd say it was highly unlikely, virtually impossible. I did have a man only a month ago with an axe injury, a 7-inch depressed fracture of the parietal bone and extensive extradural hemorrhage. He went off to a pub, spent 30 minutes with his mates, and then reported to the casualty department and was dead within 15 minutes. Head injuries can be unpredictable, but not this one, I think." Dalgleish turned to Howarth. "Who found him?" "Our clerical officer, Brenda Pridmore. She starts work at 8:30 with Blakelock. Old Mr. Lorimer phoned to say that his son hadn't slept in his bed, so she went up to see if Lorimer were here.
I arrived almost immediately with the cleaner, Mrs. Bidwell. Some woman had telephoned her husband early this morning to ask her to come to my house to help my sister instead of to the lab. It was a false call. I thought it was probably some stupid village prank, but that I'd better get in as soon as possible in case something odd was happening. So I put her bicycle in the trunk of my car and got here just after 9. My secretary, Angela Foley, and Clifford Bradley, the higher scientific officer in the biology department, arrived at about the same time.
Who at any time has been alone with the body?
Brenda Pridmore, of course, but very briefly, I imagine. Then Inspector Blakelock came up on his own. Then I was here alone for no more than a few seconds. Then I locked the laboratory door, kept all the staff in the main hall, and waited there until Dr. Kerrison arrived. He was here within 5 minutes and examined the body. I stood by the door. Superintendent Mercer arrived shortly afterwards, and I handed over the key of the biology lab to him. Mercer said, "Dr. Kerrison suggested that I call in Dr. Green. He's the local police surgeon, to confirm his preliminary findings. Dr. Green wasn't alone with the body. After he'd made a quick and fairly superficial examination, I locked the door. It wasn't opened again until the photographers and the fingerprint officers arrived. They've taken his dabs and examined the mallet, but we left it at that when we knew the yard had been called in and you were on the way. The print boys are still here in the police liaison officer's room, but I let the photographers go." Putting on his search gloves, Dalgleish ran his hands over the body. Under his white coat, Lorimer was wearing grey slacks and a tweed jacket. In the inside pocket was a thin leather wallet containing 6-pound notes, his driver's licence, a book of stamps, and 2 credit cards. The right outer pocket held a pouch with his car keys and 3 others, 2 Yale and a smaller intricate key, probably to a desktop or drawer. There were a couple of ballpoint pens clipped to the top left-hand pocket of his white coat. In the bottom right-hand pocket was a handkerchief, his bunch of laboratory keys, and, not on the bunch, a single heavy key, which looked fairly new. There was nothing else on the body. He went over to study 2 exhibits lying on the central workbench, the mallet and a man's jacket. The mallet was an unusual weapon, obviously handmade. The handle of crudely carved oak was about 18 inches long, and might, he thought, have once been part of a heavy walking stick. The head, which he judged to weigh just over 2 pounds, was blackened on one side with congealed blood, from which 1 or 2 coarse grey hairs sprouted like whiskers. It was impossible to detect in the dried slough a darker hair which might have come from Lorimer's head, or with the naked eye to distinguish his blood. That would be a job for the Metropolitan Police Laboratory, when the mallet, carefully packed, and with 2 identifying exhibit tags instead of 1, reached the biology department later in the day. He said to the superintendent, "No prints?" "None, except for old Pascoe's. He's the owner of the mallet. They weren't wiped away, so it looks as if this chap wore gloves." That, thought Dalgleish, would point to premeditation, or to the instinctive precaution of a knowledgeable expert. But if he came prepared to kill, it was odd that he had relied on seizing the first convenient weapon. Unless, of course, he knew that the mallet would be ready to hand. He bent low to study the jacket. It was the top half of a cheap, mass-produced suit, in a harsh shade of blue with a paler pinstripe, and with wide lapels. The sleeve had been carefully spread out, and the cuff bore a trace of what could have been blood. It was apparent that Lorimer had already begun the analysis. On the bench was the electrophoresis apparatus, plugged into its power pack, and with 2 columns of 6 paired small circles punched in the sheet of agar gel. Beside it was a test tube holder with a series of blood samples. To the right lay a couple of buff-coloured laboratory files with the biology registrations, and beside them, flat open on the bench, a quarto-sized loose-leaf notebook with a ring binding.
The left-hand page, dated the previous day, was closely covered in hieroglyphics and formulas in a thin, black, upright hand. Although most of the scientific jottings meant little to him, Dalgliesh could see that the time at which Lorimer had started and finished each analysis had been carefully noted. The right-hand page was blank. He said to Howarth, "Who is the senior biologist now that Lorimer's dead?"
"Claire Easterbrook, Miss Easterbrook, but it's advisable to call her Ms."
"Is she here?"
"With the others in the library. I believe she has a firm alibi for the whole of yesterday evening, but as she's a senior scientist, she was asked to stay. And of course she'll want to get back to work as soon as the staff are allowed into the laboratory. There was a murder 2 nights ago in a clunch pit at Muddington. That jacket is an exhibit. And she'll want to get on with that, as well as coping with the usual heavy load."
"I'd like to see her first, please, and here. Then Mrs. Bidwell. Is there a sheet we could use to cover him?"
Howarth said, "I imagine there's a dust sheet or something of the kind in the linen cupboard. That's on the next floor."
"I'd be grateful if you'd go with Inspector Massingham and show him. Then if you'd wait in the library or your own office, I'll be down to have a word when I've finished here."
For a second he thought that Howarth was about to demur. He frowned, and the handsome face clouded momentarily, petulant as a child's. But he left with Massingham without a word. Kerrison was still standing by the body, rigid as a guard of honour. He gave a little start, as if recalling himself to reality, and said, "If you don't want me any longer, I ought to be on my way to the hospital. You can contact me at St. Luke's at Ely, or here at the old rectory. I've given the sergeant an account of my movements last night. I was at home all the evening. At 9 o'clock, by arrangement, I rang one of my colleagues at the hospital, Dr. J.D. Underwood, about a matter which is coming up at the next medical committee. I think he's already confirmed that we did speak. He hadn't got the information I was waiting for, but he rang me back at about 9:45. There was as little reason to delay Kerrison as there was at present to suspect him. After he had left, Mercer said, "I thought of leaving 2 sergeants, Reynolds and Underhill, and a couple of constables, Cox and Warren, if that will suit you. They're all sound, experienced officers. The chief said to ask for anyone and anything you need. He's at a meeting in London this morning, but he'll be back tonight. I'll send up the chaps from the mortuary van if you're ready for them to take him away." "Yes, I've finished with him. I'll have a word with your men as soon as I've seen Miss Easterbrook. But ask one of the sergeants to come up in 10 minutes to pack up the mallet for the yard, lad, will you? The chopper pilot will want to get back." They spoke a few more words about the liaison arrangements with the local force, then Mercer left to supervise the removal of the body. He would wait to introduce Dalgliesh to his seconded officers. After that, his responsibility would end. The case was in Dalgliesh's hands.
Chapter 6. 2 minutes later, Claire Easterbrook was shown into the laboratory. She entered with an assurance that a less experienced investigator than Dalgliesh might have mistaken for arrogance or insensitivity. She was a thin, long-waisted girl of about 30, with a bony, intelligent face and a cap of dark, curling hair, which had been layered by an obviously expert and no doubt expensive hand to lie in swathes across the forehead and to curl into the nape of her high-arched neck. She was wearing a chestnut-brown sweater in fine wool, belted into a black skirt which swung calf-length above high-heeled boots. Her hands, with the nails cut very short, were ringless, and her only ornament was a necklace of large wooden beads strung on a silver chain. Even without her white coat, the impression she gave, and no doubt intended, was of a slightly intimidating professional competence. Before Dalgliesh had a chance to speak, she said, with a trace of belligerence, "I'm afraid you'll be wasting your time with me. My lover and I dined last night in Cambridge at the master's lodge of his college. I was with 5 other people from 8:30 until nearly midnight. I've already given their names to the constable in the library."
Dalgliesh said mildly. "I'm sorry, Ms. Easterbrook, that I had to ask you to come up before we were able to remove Dr. Lorimer's body. And as it seems impertinent to invite you to sit down in your own laboratory, I won't. But this isn't going to take long." She flushed, as if he had caught her out in a social solecism. Glancing with reluctant distaste at the shrouded lumpen shape on the floor, at the stiff, protruding ankles, she said, "He'd look more dignified if you left him uncovered. Like this, he could be a sack of rubbish. It's a curious superstition, the universal instinct to cover up the recently dead. After all, we're the ones at a disadvantage." Massingham said lightly, "Not surely with the master and his wife to vouch for your alibi." Their eyes met, his coolly amused, hers dark with dislike. Dalgliesh said, "Dr. Howarth tells me you're the senior biologist now. Could you explain to me, please, what Dr. Lorimer was doing here last night? Don't touch anything." She went at once over to the table and regarded the two exhibits, the files and the scientific paraphernalia. She said, "Would you open this file, please?" Dalgliesh's gloved hand slipped between the covers and flipped it open. "He rechecked Clifford Bradley's result on the Pascoe case. The mallet belongs to a 64-year-old Fen Farm labourer called Pascoe, whose wife has disappeared. His story is that she's walked out on him, but there are one or two suspicious circumstances. The police sent in the mallet to see if the stains on it are human blood. They aren't. Pascoe says that he used it to put an injured dog out of his misery. Bradley found that the blood reacted to anti-dog serum, and Dr. Lorimer has duplicated his result. So the dog it was that died." Too mean to waste a bullet or send for a vet, thought Massingham savagely. It struck him as odd that the death of this unknown mongrel should, for a moment, anger him more than the killing of Lorimer. Miss Easterbrook moved over to the open notebook. The two men waited. Then she frowned and said, obviously puzzled, "That's odd. Edwin always noted the time he began and finished an analysis and the procedure he adopted. He's initialled Bradley's result on the Pascoe file, but there's nothing in the book. And it's obvious that he's made a start with the Clunch Pit murder, but that isn't noted either. The last reference is 5:45 and the final note is unfinished. Someone must have torn out the right-hand page." "Why do you suppose anyone should do that?" She looked straight into Dalgliesh's eyes and said calmly, "To destroy the evidence of what he'd been doing, or the result of his analysis, or the time he'd spent on it. The first and second would be rather pointless. It's obvious from the apparatus what he's been doing, and any competent biologist could duplicate the work. So it's probably the last." So the appearance of intelligence wasn't misleading. Dalgliesh asked, "How long would he take checking the Pascoe result?" "Not long. Actually, he'd started on that before 6, and I think he'd finished when I left at 6:15. I was the last to leave. The junior staff had gone. It isn't usual for them to work after 6. I usually stay later, but I had to dress for the dinner party." "And the work he's done on the Clunch Pit case, how long would that have taken?" "Difficult to say. I should have thought it would have kept him busy until 9 or later." He was grouping a sample of the victim's blood and the blood from the dried stain by the ABO blood group system, and using electrophoresis to identify the haptoglobins and PGM, the enzyme phosphoglucomutase. Electrophoresis is a technique for identifying the protein and enzyme constituents of the blood by placing the samples in a gel of starch or agar and applying an electric current. As you can see, he'd actually started the run. Dalgliesh was aware of the scientific principle of electrophoresis, but didn't think it necessary to mention the fact. He opened the Clunch Pit file and said, "There's nothing on the file." "He would write up the result on the file later, but he wouldn't have started the analysis without noting the details in his book.
There were two pedal bins against the wall. Massingham opened them. One, plastic-lined, was obviously for laboratory waste and broken glass. The other was for waste paper. He stirred the contents. Paper, tissues, a few torn envelopes, a discarded newspaper. There was nothing that resembled the missing page. Dalgleish said,
"Tell me about Lorimer.
What is it you want to know?"
"Anything that could throw light on why someone disliked him enough to smash in his skull."
"I can't help you there, I'm afraid. I've no idea."
"You liked him?"
"Not particularly. Not a question I've given much thought to. I got on all right with him. He was a perfectionist who didn't suffer fools gladly. But he was all right to work with if you knew your job."
"I do."
"So he wouldn't need to check your work.
What about those who don't know their jobs?"
"You'd better ask them, Commander."
"Was he popular with his staff?"
"What has popularity to do with it? I don't suppose I'm popular, but I don't go in fear of my life."
She was silent for a moment, then said in a more conciliatory tone,
"I probably sound obstructive. I don't mean to be. It's just that I can't help. I've no idea who could have killed him or why. I only know that I didn't."
"Had you noticed any change in him recently?"
"Change? You mean in his mood or behaviour?"
"Not really. He gave the impression of a man under strain, but then he was that kind of man. Solitary, obsessional, overworked."
"One rather odd thing. He's been interesting himself in the new CO, Brenda Pridmore. A pretty child, but hardly his intellectual level, I should have thought. I don't think there was anything serious, but it caused a certain amount of amusement in the lab. I think he was probably trying to prove something to someone, or perhaps to himself."
"You have heard about the telephone call to Mrs. Bidwell, of course."
"I imagine the whole lab knows. It wasn't I who rang her, if that's what you're thinking. In any case, I should have known that it wouldn't work."
"How do you mean it wouldn't work?"
"It depended, surely, on old Lorimer not being at home yesterday. After all, the caller couldn't rely on his not noticing that Edwin hadn't come home last night until he didn't get his early tea brought to him. As it happens, he went off to bed quite happily. But the hoaxer couldn't have known that. Normally, Edwin would have been missed much earlier."
"Was there any reason to suppose that old Mr. Lorimer wouldn't be at the cottage yesterday?"
"He was supposed to be admitted to Addenbrooke's hospital in the afternoon for treatment of a skin complaint. I think the whole biology lab knew. He used to telephone often enough, fretting about the arrangements and whether Edwin would get time off to drive in there. Yesterday, just after 10, he rang to say that the bed wouldn't be available for him after all."
"Who took the call?"
"I did. It rang in his private office, and I took it there. Edwin hadn't returned from the Clunchpit autopsy. I told him as soon as he arrived."
"Whom else did you tell?"
"When I came out of the office, I think I said something casually about old Mr. Lorimer not having to go into the hospital after all. I'm not sure of the actual words. I don't think anyone made a comment or took much apparent notice."
"And all the biology staff were in the lab at the time and heard you?"
Suddenly she lost her composure. She flushed and hesitated, as if realizing for the first time where all this was leading. The two men waited. Then, angry with herself, she burst out, clumsily defensive, "I'm sorry, but I can't remember. You'll have to ask them. It didn't seem important at the time, and I was busy. We were all busy. I think everyone was there, but I can't be certain."
"Thank you," said Dalgleish coolly. "You've been remarkably helpful."
Chapter 7. Mrs. Bidwell arrived at the door as the two attendants from the mortuary van were carrying out the body. She seemed to regret its disappearance,
and looked at the chalk outline marked by Massingham on the floor, as if this were a poor substitute for the real thing. Gazing after the covered metal container, she said, "Poor devil. I never thought to see him carried out of his lab feet first. He were never popular, you know. Still, I don't suppose that's worrying him where he is now. Is that one of my dust sheets you had over him?" She peered suspiciously at the sheet, now folded neatly at the end of one of the benches. "It came from the laboratory linen cupboard, yes." "Well, as long as it put back where you found it. Come to that, it better go straight into the soiled linen. But I don't want any of your chaps taking it away. Laundry disappears fast enough as it is." "Why wasn't he popular, Mrs. Bidwell?" "Too particular by half. Mind you, you've got to be these days if you want to get any work done. But from what I hear, he was too fussy for his own good. And he's been getting worse, no doubt about that. And very odd he'd been lately, too. Nervy. You heard about the unpleasantness in the reception hall the day before yesterday, I suppose? Ah, well, you will. Ask Inspector Blakelock. Just before lunch it was. Dr. Lorimer had a real old tussle with that balmy daughter of Dr. Kerrison's. Nearly pushed her out of the door. Screeching like a banshee, she was. I come into the hall, just in time to see it. 'Her dad isn't going to like that,' I said to Inspector Blakelock. 'He's crazy about those kids. Mark my words,' I said. 'If Dr. Lorimer doesn't take a hold of himself, there'll be murder done in this lab.' I said the same to Mr. Middlemas."
"I want you to tell me about the telephone call this morning, Mrs. Bidwell. What time was it?"
"It was near enough 7 o'clock. We was eating breakfast, and I'd just filled the teapot for second cups. I had the kettle in me hand when it rang."
"And who answered it?"
"Bidwell. Phone's in the hall, and he got up and went out to it. Cursing he was, 'cause he'd just settled down to his kipper. He hates cold kipper, does Bidwell. We always has kippers on Thursday, on account of Marshall's fish van coming from Ely Wednesday afternoons."
"Does your husband usually answer the phone?"
"He always answers the phone. And if he's not in, I lets it ring. I can't abide the dratted things. Never could. Wouldn't have it put in our house if our Shirley hadn't paid to get it put in. She's married now and lives Mildenhall way, and she likes to think we can ring her if we want her. Fat lot of use that is. I can't never hear what anyone says, and the ring is enough to put the fear of God in a soul. Telegrams and phone rings, I hate them both."
"Who at the lab would know that your husband always answered the phone?"
"Best part of them, more than likely. They knows I won't touch the thing. There's no secret about that. We're all as the good Lord made us, and some of us is a sight worse. Nothing to be ashamed of."
"Of course not. Your husband's at work now, I expect."
"That's right. Yeoman's Farm. Captain Massey's place. Tractor work, mostly. Been there 20 years, near enough."
Dalgleish nodded almost imperceptibly to Massingham, and the inspector slipped out to have a quiet word with Sergeant Underhill. It would be as well to check with Mr. Bidwell while his memory of the call was fresh. Dalgleish went on. "What happened then?"
"Bidwell came back. Said I wasn't to go to the lab this morning because Mrs. Schofield wanted me over at Leamings, particular. I was to bike there, and she'd run me in the bike home afterwards. Sticking out of the back of that red Jaguar she's got, I suppose. I thought it was a bit of a cheek, seeing as I'm due here mornings. But I've nothing against Mrs. Schofield, and if she wanted me, I wasn't above obliging. The lab would just have to wait, I said to Bidwell. I can't be in two places at once, I said. What don't get done today will get done tomorrow."
"You work here every morning?"
"Except weekends, that's right. Gets here as near 8:30 as makes no odds, and works till about 10. Then back at 12, in case any of the gentlemen wants their lunch cooking. The girls mostly manage for themselves. Afterwards I washes up for 'em. I reckons to get away by 2:30 most days. Mind you, it's light work. Scobie, he's the lab attendant, and I sees to the work in labs. But all the heavy cleaning is supposed to be done by the contractors. They comes in on Mondays and Fridays only, from 7 till 9, a whole van full of 'em from Ely, and does the main hall, the stairs, and all the heavy polishing. Inspector Blakelock gets here early those mornings to let them in, and Scobie keeps an eye on them. Not that you'd know they'd been most days. No personal interest, you see. Not like the old days, when me and two women from the village did the lot.
So what would you normally have done as soon as you arrived, if this had been an ordinary Thursday?
I want you to think carefully, Mrs. Bidwell. This may be very important.
No need to think. I do the same as I does every day.
Which is?
Take off me hat and coat in the downstairs cloakroom, put on me overalls, get cleaning bucket and powder and disinfectant from the broom cupboard, clean the toilets, male and female, then check dirty laundry and get it bagged up, put out clean white coats where wanted, then dust and tidy director's office and general office.
Right, said Dalgleish. Let's do the rounds then, shall we? 3 minutes later, a curious little procession made its way up the stairs. Mrs. Bidwell, clad now in a navy blue working overall and carrying a plastic bucket in one hand and a mop in the other, led the way. Dalgleish and Massingham followed. The two lavatories were on the top floor at the rear, opposite the document examination laboratory. They had obviously been converted from what had once been an elegant bedroom, but now a narrow passage leading to the single barred window had been constructed down the middle of the room. A mean-looking door gave entrance to the women's cloakroom on the left, and a few yards down, a similar door led to the men's washroom on the right. Mrs. Bidwell led the way into the left-hand room. It was larger than Dalgleish had expected, but poorly lit from a single round window with pivoting opaque glass set about 4 feet from the floor. The window was open. There were three cubicles. The outer room contained two lavatory hand basins with a paper towel dispenser, and to the left of the door, a long formica-covered counter with a glass above it, which apparently served as a dressing table. To the right was a wall-mounted gas-fired incinerator, a row of clothes hooks, a large wicker laundry basket, and two rather battered cane chairs. Dalgleish said to Mrs. Bidwell, "Is this how you would expect to find it?" Mrs. Bidwell's sharp little eyes peered round. The doors to the three lavatories were open, and she gave them a quick inspection. "No better, nor no worse. They're pretty good about the toilets, I'll say that for 'em. And the window is usually kept open. Winter and summer, except it's bitter cold. That's the only ventilation, you see. The incinerator is off, is that usual?" "That's right. Last girl to leave turns it off at night, then I puts it on next morning." Dalgleish looked inside. The incinerator was empty, except for a trace of carbon ash. He went over to the window. Rain had obviously driven in sometime during the night, and the dried splashes were clearly visible on the tiled floor. But even the inside pane, where no rain could have splashed, was remarkably clean, and there was no discernible dust around the sill. He said, "Did you clean the window yesterday, Mrs. Bidwell?"
"Of course I did. It's like I told you. I cleans the lavatories every morning, and when I cleans, I cleans. Shall I get on with it now?"
"I'm afraid there'll be no cleaning done today. We'll pretend that you've finished in here. Now what happens? What about the laundry?"
The laundry basket contained only one coat, marked with the initial CME. Mrs. Bidwell said,
"I wouldn't expect many dirty coats, not on a Thursday. They usually manages to make them last a week, and drop them in here on Friday before they go home. Monday's the busy day for laundry, and putting out the new coats. Looks as though Miss Easterbrook spilled her tea yesterday. That's not like her. But she's particular, is Miss Easterbrook. You wouldn't find her going around with a dirty coat, no matter what day of the week."
So there was at least one member of the biology department, thought Dalgleish, who knew that Mrs. Bidwell would make an early visit to the lab to put out a clean white coat. It would be interesting to learn who had been present when the fastidious Miss Easterbrook had had her accident with the tea. The male washroom, apart from the urinal stalls, differed very little from the women's. There was the same round open window, the same absence of any marks on the panes or sill. Dalgleish carried over one of the chairs,
and carefully avoiding any contact with the window or the sill, looked out. There was a drop of about 6 feet to the top of the window beneath, and an equal drop to that on the first floor. Below them both, a paved terrace ran right up to the wall. The absence of soft earth, the rain in the night, and Mrs. Bidwell's efficient cleaning meant that they would be lucky to find any evidence of a climb. But a reasonably slim and sure-footed man or woman with enough nerve and a head for heights could certainly have got out this way. But if the murderer were a member of the lab staff, why should he risk his neck when he must have known that the keys were on Lorimer? And if the murderer were an outsider, then how account for the locked front door, the intact alarm system, and the fact that Lorimer must have let him in? He turned his attention to the wash basins. None was particularly dirty, but near the rim of the one nearest the door there was a smear of porridge-like mucus. He bent his head over the basin and sniffed. His sense of smell was extremely acute. And from the plug hole he detected the faint but unmistakably disagreeable smell of human vomit. Mrs. Bidwell, meanwhile, had thrown open the lid of the laundry basket. She gave an exclamation. "That's funny. It's empty." Dalgliesh and Massingham turned. Dalgliesh asked, "What were you expecting to find, Mrs. Bidwell?" "Mr. Middlemiss's white coat, that's what." She darted out of the room. Dalgliesh and Massingham followed. She flung open the door of the document examination room and glanced inside. Then she closed the door again and stood with her back against it. She said, "It's gone. It's not hanging on the peg. So where is it? Where's Mr. Middlemiss's white coat?" Dalgliesh asked, "Why did you expect to find it in the laundry basket?" Mrs. Bidwell's black eyes grew immense. She slewed her eyes furtively from side to side, and then said with awed relish, "Because it had blood on it. That's why. Lorimer's blood." Chapter 8. Lastly, they went down the main staircase to the director's office. From the library there was a broken murmur of voices, subdued and spasmodic as a funeral gathering. A detective constable was standing at the front door with the detached watchfulness of a man paid to endure boredom, but ready to leap into action should, unaccountably, the boredom end. Howarth had left his office unlocked and the key in the door. Dalgliesh was interested that the director had chosen to wait with the rest of the staff in the library, and wondered whether this was intended to demonstrate solidarity with his colleagues, or was a tactful admission that his office was one of the rooms that had been due to receive Mrs. Bidwell's early morning attention, and must therefore be of special interest to Dalgliesh. But that reasoning was surely too subtle. It was difficult to believe that Howarth hadn't entered his room since the discovery of the body. If there were anything to remove, he, best of all, must have had the chance to do it. Dalgliesh had expected the room to be impressive, but it still surprised him. The plasterwork of the coved ceiling was splendid. A joyous riot of wreaths, shells, ribbons and trailing vines, ornate and yet disciplined. The fireplace was of white and mottled marble, with a finely carved frieze of nymphs and piping shepherds, and a classical overmantel with open pediment. He guessed that the agreeably proportioned salon, too small to be partitioned and not large enough for a working laboratory, had escaped the fate of so much of the house, more for administrative and scientific convenience than from any sensitivity on Colonel Hoggart's part to its innate perfection. It was newly furnished, in a style guaranteed not to offend, a nice compromise of bureaucratic orthodoxy and modern functionalism. There was a large glass-fronted bookcase to the left of the fireplace, and a personal locker and a coat stand to the right. A rectangular conference table and four chairs of a type provided for senior public servants stood between the tall windows. Next to it was a steel security cupboard fitted with a combination lock. Howarth's desk, a plain contraption in the same wood as the conference table, faced the door. Apart from an ink-stained blotter and a pen stand, it held a small wooden bookshelf containing the Shorter Oxford Dictionary,
a dictionary of quotations, Roger's Thesaurus, and Fowler's Modern English Usage. The choice seemed curious for a scientist. There were three metal trays marked In, Pending, and Out. The Out tray held two manila files, the top labelled Chapel, Proposals for Transfer to Department of the Environment, and the second, a large, old and unwieldy file, which had been much mended, was marked New Laboratory Commissioning. Dalgleish was struck by the emptiness and impersonality of the whole room. It had obviously been recently decorated for Howarth's arrival. The pale grey-green carpet with its matching square under the desk was as yet unmarked, and the curtains hung in pristine folds of dark green. There was only one picture, positioned in the overmantel, but this was an original, an early Stanley Spencer showing the Assumption of the Virgin. Plump, foreshortened, varicosed thighs in red bloomers floated upward from a circle of clutching, work-worn hands to a reception committee of gaping cherubim. It was, he thought, an eccentric choice for the room, discordant both in date and in style. It was the only object, apart from the books, that reflected a personal taste. Dalgleish hardly supposed that it had been provided by a government agency. Otherwise, the office had the underfurnished, expectant atmosphere of a room refurbished to receive an unknown occupant and still awaiting the imprint of his taste and personality. It was hard to believe that Howarth had worked here for almost a year. Mrs. Bidwell, her tight little mouth pursed and eyes narrowed, regarded it with obvious disapproval. Dalgleish asked, "Is this how you would have expected to find it?" "That's right. Every bloody morning. Nothing for me to do here, really, is there? Mind you, I dusts and polishes around and runs the hoover over the carpet. But he's neat and tidy, there's no denying it. Not like old Dr. McIntyre. Oh, he was a lovely man. But messy? You should have seen his desk of a morning. And smoke? You could hardly see across the room sometimes. He had this lovely skull on his desk to keep his pipes in. They dug it up when they was making the trench for the pipes to the new vehicle examination extension. Been in the ground more than 200 years, Dr. Mac said. And he showed me the crack, just like a cracked cup, where his skull had been bashed in. That's one murder they never solved. I miss that skull. Real lovely that used to look. And he had all those pictures of himself and his friends at university with oars crossed above them. And a coloured one of the Highlands, with hairy cattle paddling in a lake. And one of his father with his dogs. And such a lovely picture of his wife. Dead she was, poor soul. And another big picture of Venice, with gondolas and a lot of foreigners in fancy dress. And a cartoon of Dr. Mac done by one of his friends, showing the friend lying dead, and Dr. Mac in his deerstalker hat looking for clues with his magnifying glass. That was a real laugh, that was. Oh, I love Dr. Mac's pictures." She looked at the Spencer with a marked lack of enthusiasm.
"And there's nothing unusual about the room this morning?"
"I told you. Same as usual. Well, look for yourself, clean as a new pin. It looks different in the day, mark you, when he's working here. But he always leaves it as if he isn't expecting to come back in the morning."
There was nothing else to be learned from Mrs. Bidwell. Dalgleish thanked her and told her that she could go home, as soon as she had checked with Detective Sergeant Reynolds in the library that he had all the necessary information about where she had spent the previous evening. He explained this with his usual tact, but tact was wasted on Mrs. Bidwell. She said cheerfully and without rancour,
"No use trying to pin this on me, or Bidwell, come to that. We was together at the village concert. Sat 5 rows back between Joe Machin, he's the sexton, and Willie Barnes, he's the rector's warden. And we stayed there until the end of the show. No sneaking out at half-time, like some I could mention."
"Who sneaked out, Mrs. Bidwell?"
"Ask him yourself. Sat at the end of a row in front of us. A gentleman whose office we might or might not be standing in at this very moment. Do you want to talk to him? Shall I ask him to step in?"
She spoke hopefully and looked towards the door like an eager gun dog, ears pricked for the command to retrieve.
"We'll see to that, thank you, Mrs. Bidwell. And if we want to talk to you again, we'll get in touch. You've been very helpful."
I thought I might make coffee for them all before I go. No harm in that, I suppose.
There was no point in warning her not to talk to the lab staff, or come to that, to the whole village. Dalgleish had no doubt that his search of the cloakrooms and the missing blood-stained coat would soon be common knowledge. But no great harm would be done. The murderer must know that the police would be immediately alive to the possible significance of that false early morning call to Mrs. Bidwell. He was dealing with intelligent men and women, experienced, even if vicariously, in criminal investigation, knowledgeable about police procedure, aware of the rules that governed his every move. He had no doubt that, mentally, most of the group now waiting in the library to be interviewed were following his actions almost to the minute. And among them, or known to them, was a murderer.
Chapter 9. Superintendent Mercer had selected his two sergeants with an eye to contrast, or perhaps with a view to satisfying any prejudices that Dalgleish might harbour about the age and experience of his subordinates. Sergeant Reynolds was near the end of his service, a stolid, broad-shouldered, slow-speaking officer of the old school and a native of the Fens. Sergeant Underhill, recently promoted, looked young enough to be his son. His boyish, open face, with its look of disciplined idealism, was vaguely familiar to Massingham, who suspected that he might have seen it in a police recruitment pamphlet, but decided in the interests of harmonious cooperation to give Underhill the benefit of the doubt. The four police officers were sitting at the conference table in the director's office. Dalgleish was briefing his team before he started on the preliminary interviews. He was, as always, restlessly aware of time passing. It was already after 11, and he was anxious to finish at the laboratory and see old Mr. Lorimer. The physical clues to his son's murder might lie in the laboratory. The clue to the man himself lay elsewhere. But neither his words nor his tone betrayed impatience. "We start by assuming that the telephone call to Mrs. Bidwell and Lorimer's death are connected. That means the call was made by the murderer or an accomplice. We'll keep an open mind about the caller's sex until we get confirmation from Bidwell, but it was probably a woman. Probably also someone who knew old Mr. Lorimer was expected to be in the hospital yesterday and who didn't know that the appointment had been cancelled. If the old man had been home, the ruse could hardly hope to succeed. As Miss Easterbrook has pointed out, no one could rely on his going early to bed last night and not realizing till after the lab opened this morning that his son hadn't come home. Massingham said, "The killer would have made it his business to get here early this morning, assuming that he didn't know that his plan had misfired, and assuming, of course, the call wasn't a double bluff. It would be a neat ploy, wasting our time, confusing the investigation, and diverting suspicion from everyone except the early arrivals. But for one of the suspects, it could have been an even neater ploy," thought Dalgleish. It had been Mrs. Bidwell's arrival at Howarth's house in obedience to the call which had given the director himself the excuse for arriving so early. He wondered what time Howarth usually put in an appearance. That would be one of the questions to be asked. He said, "We'll start by assuming that it wasn't a bluff, that the murderer or his accomplice made the call to delay Mrs. Bidwell's arrival and the discovery of the body. So what was he hoping to do? Plant evidence or destroy it? Tidy up something that he'd overlooked? Wipe the mallet clean? Clear up the evidence of whatever it was he was doing here last night? Replace the keys on the body? But Blakelock had the best opportunity to do that, and he wouldn't need to have taken them in the first place. The call could have given someone the chance to replace the spare set in the security cupboard here. But that would be perfectly possible without delaying Mrs. Bidwell's arrival. And of course it may have been done." Underhill said, "But is it really likely, sir, that the call was intended to delay the finding of the body and to give the killer time to replace the keys? Admittedly, Mrs. Bidwell could be expected to be first in the biology department this morning, when she put out the clean coats. But the murderer couldn't rely on that. Inspector Blakelock or Brenda Pridmore could easily have had occasion to go there.
Dalgliesh thought it a risk that the murderer might well have thought worth taking. In his experience, the early morning routine in an institution seldom varied. Unless Blakelock had the early morning job of checking on lab security, and this was yet another of the questions to be asked, he and Brenda Pridmore would probably have got on with their normal work at the reception desk. In the ordinary course of events, Mrs. Bidwell would have been the one to find the body. Any member of staff who went into the biology lab before her would have needed a good excuse to explain his presence there, unless, of course, he was a member of the biology department. Massingham said, "It's odd about the missing white coat, sir. It can hardly have been removed or destroyed to prevent us learning about the fight between Middlemas and Lorimer. That unedifying but intriguing little episode must have been around the lab within minutes of its happening. Mrs. Bidwell will see to that." Both Dalgliesh and Massingham wondered how far Mrs. Bidwell's description of the quarrel, given with the maximum dramatic effect, had been accurate. It was obvious that she had come into the laboratory after the blow had been struck, and had in fact seen very little. Dalgliesh had recognised with foreboding a familiar phenomenon, the desire of a witness, aware of the paucity of her evidence, to make the most of it, lest the police be disappointed, while remaining as far as possible within the confines of truth. Stripped of Mrs. Bidwell's embellishments, the core of hard fact had been disappointingly small.
"What they was quarrelling about, I couldn't take it on myself to say, except that it was about a lady, and that Dr. Lorimer was upset because she telephoned Mr. Middlemas. The door was open, and I did hear that much when I passed to go to the lady's toilet. I dare say she rang him to arrange a date, and Dr. Lorimer didn't like it. I never saw a man more white. Like death he looked, with a handkerchief held up against his face all bloodied, and his black eyes glaring over the top of it. And Mr. Middlemas was turkey red. Embarrassed, I dare say. Well, it's not what we're used to at Hoggart's, senior staff knocking each other about. When proper gentlemen start in with the fist, there's usually a woman at the bottom of it. Same with this murder, if you ask me."
Dalgliesh said, "We'll be getting Middlemas's version of the affair. I'd like now to have a word with all the lab staff in the library, and then Inspector Massingham and I will start the preliminary interviews. Howarth, the two women, Angela Foley and Brenda Pridmore, Blakelock, Middlemas, and any of the others without a firm alibi. I'd like you, Sergeant, to get on with organising the usual routine. I shall want one of the senior staff in each department while the search is going on. They're the only ones who can tell whether anything in their lab has changed since yesterday. You'll be looking, admittedly without much hope, for the missing page of Lorimer's notebook. Any evidence of what he was doing here last night apart from working on the Clunch Pit murder? Any sign of what happened to the missing coat? I want a thorough search of the whole building, particularly possible means of access and exit. The rain last night is a nuisance. You'll probably find the walls washed clean, but there may be some evidence that he got out through one of the lavatory windows. You'll need a couple of men on the grounds. The earth is fairly soft after the rain, and if the murderer came by car or motorcycle, there could be tire marks. Any we find can be checked against the tire index here. We needn't waste time going to the Met Lab for that. There's a bus stop immediately opposite the laboratory entrance. Find out what time the buses pass. There's always the possibility that one of the passengers or crew noticed something. I'd like the laboratory building checked first and as quickly as possible, so that the staff can get back to work. They've a new murder on their hands, and we can't keep the place closed longer than is absolutely necessary. I'd like to give them access by tomorrow morning. Then there's the smear of what looks like vomit on the first basin in the men's washroom. The smell from the pipe is still fairly distinct. I want a sample of that to go to the Met Lab urgently. You'll probably have to unscrew the joint to get at the base of the U-bend. We shall need to find out who used the room last yesterday evening and whether he noticed the smear on the basin. If no one admits to having been sick during the day, or can't produce a witness that he was, we shall want to know what they all ate for the evening meal. It could be Lorimer's vomit, so we'll need some information on his stomach contents. I'd also like a sample of his blood and hair to be left here at the lab. But Dr. Blaine Thompson will be seeing to that." Reynolds said,
We take it that the crucial time is from 6:15, when he was last seen alive in his lab, until midnight? For the present. When I've seen his father and confirmed that he made the call at 8:45, we may be able to narrow it down. And we shall get a clearer idea of the time of death when Dr. Blaine Thompson has done the PM. But judging from the state of Rigor, Dr. Kerrison wasn't far out. But Kerrison didn't need to be far out, if he were the murderer. Rigor mortis was notoriously unreliable, and if he wanted an alibi for himself, Kerrison could shift the time of death by up to an hour without suspicion. If the timing were tight, he might not need even an hour. It had been prudent of him to call in the police surgeon to confirm his estimate of the time of death, but how likely was Dr. Green, experienced as he might be in viewing bodies, to disagree with the opinion of a consultant forensic pathologist, unless the latter's judgment was manifestly perverse? If Kerrison were guilty, he had run little risk by calling in Green. Dalgleish got to his feet. "Right," he said. "Let's get on with it, shall we?"
Chapter 10. Dalgleish disliked having more than one other officer present with him at his preliminary and formal interview, so Massingham was taking the notes. They were hardly necessary. Dalgleish, he knew, had almost total recall. But he still found the practice useful. They were sitting together at the conference table in the director's office, but Howarth, perhaps because he objected to sitting in his own room other than at his desk, preferred to stand. He was leaning casually against the fireplace. From time to time, Massingham lifted an unobtrusive eyebrow to glance at the clear-cut, dominant profile outlined against the classical frieze. There were three bunches of keys on the table. The bunch taken from Lorimer's body, that handed over by Inspector Blakelock, and the set that Dr. Howarth, manipulating the security lock, had taken from its box in the cupboard. Each set of keys was identical. One Yale key and two security keys to the front door, and one smaller key on a plain metal ring. None was named, presumably for security reasons. Dalgleish said, "And these are the only three sets in existence?"
"Except for the set at Guy's Marsh Police Station, yes. Naturally, I checked earlier this morning that the police still have their set. The keys are kept in the safe under the control of the station officer, and they haven't been touched. They need a set at the police station in case the alarm goes off. There was no alarm last night."
Dalgleish already knew from Mercer that the station keys had been checked. He said,
"And the smallest key?"
"That's the one to the exhibits store. The system is for all incoming exhibits, after they've been registered, to be stored there until they're issued to the head of the appropriate department. It's his responsibility to allocate them to a specific officer. In addition, we store the exhibits that have been examined and are awaiting collection by the police, and those that have been presented to the court during the case and are returned to us for destruction. Those are mainly drugs. They're destroyed here in the incinerator, and the destruction witnessed by one of the laboratory staff and the officer in charge of the case. The exhibit store is also protected by the electronic alarm system, but obviously we need a key for internal security when the system hasn't been set.
And all the laboratory internal doors and your office were protected last night, once the internal alarm system was set? That means that an intruder could only have got out undetected through the top-floor lavatory windows. All the others are either barred or fitted with electronic alarm?
That's right. He could have got in that way, too, of course, which was what concerned us most. But it wouldn't have been an easy climb, and the alarm would have gone off as soon as he tried to gain access to any of the main rooms in the laboratory. We did consider extending the alarm system to the lavatory suite soon after I arrived, but it seemed unnecessary. We haven't had a break-in in the 70-odd years of the lab's existence.
What are the precise arrangements about locking the laboratory? Only the two police liaison officers and Lorimer as the deputy security officer were authorized to lock up. He,
or the police liaison officer on duty was responsible for ensuring that no staff were left on the premises and that all the internal doors were shut before the alarm was set and the front door finally locked for the night. The alarm system to Guy's Marsh police station is set whether the door is locked on the inside or the out. And these other keys found on the body, the three in this leather pouch and the single key, do you recognise any of those? Not the three in the pouch. One is obviously his car key, and I take it that the other two are house keys. But the single one looks very like the key to the Wren Chapel. If it is, I didn't know that Lorimer had it. Not that it's important. But as far as I know, there's only one key to the chapel in existence, and that's hanging on the board in the chief liaison officer's room. It isn't a security lock, and we're not particularly worried about the chapel. There's nothing left there of real value. But occasionally architects and archaeological societies want to view it, so we let them borrow the key and they sign for it in a book in the office. We don't allow them through the laboratory grounds to get at it. They have to use the back entrance in Guy's Marsh Road. The contract cleaners take it once every 2 months to clean and check the heating. We have to keep it reasonably warm in winter because the ceiling and carving are rather fine. And Miss Willard goes there from time to time to do some dusting. When her father was rector of Cheversham, he used occasionally to hold services in the chapel, and I think she has a sentimental regard for the place. Massingham went out to Chief Inspector Martin's office and brought in the chapel key. The two matched. The small notebook which he had found hanging with the key showed that it had last been collected by Miss Willard on Monday the 25th of October. Howarth said, "We're thinking of transferring the chapel to the Department of the Environment once we occupy the new laboratory. It's a constant irritation to the Treasury that our funds are used to heat and maintain it. I've set up a string quartet here, and we held a concert on August the 26th in the chapel, but otherwise it's completely unused. I expect you'll want to take a look at it, and it's worth seeing in its own right. It's a very fine specimen of late 17th-century church architecture, although, in fact, it isn't by Wren, but by Alexander Fort, who was strongly influenced by him." Dalgleish asked suddenly, "How well did you get on with Lorimer?" Howarth replied calmly, "Not particularly well. I respected him as a biologist, and I certainly had no complaints, either about his work or about his cooperation with me as director. He wasn't an easy man to know, and I didn't find him particularly sympathetic. But he was probably one of the most respected serologists in the service, and we shall miss him. If he had a fault, it was reluctance to delegate. He has two scientific officer serologists in his department for the grouping of liquid blood and stains, saliva and semen samples, but he invariably took the murder cases himself. Apart from his casework and attendance at trials and at scenes of crime, he did a considerable amount of lecturing to detective training courses and police familiarisation courses." Lorimer's rough notebook was on the desk. Dalgleish pushed it toward Howarth and said, "Have you seen this before?" "His rough notebook? Yes. I think I've noticed it in his department or when he was carrying it with him. He was obsessively tidy and had a dislike of odd scraps of paper. Anything of importance was noted in that book and subsequently transferred to the files. Claire Easterbrook tells me that the last page is missing." "That's why we are particularly anxious to know what he was doing here last night, apart from working on the Clunch Pit murder. He could have got into any of the other laboratories, of course. If he'd switched off the internal alarm, yes. I believe it was his usual practice when he was last on the premises to rely on the Yale lock and the bolt on the front door, and only check the internal doors and set the security alarm before he finally left. Obviously it's important not to set off the alarm accidentally." "Would he have been competent to undertake an examination in another department?" "It depends on what he was trying to do. Essentially, of course, he was concerned with the identification and grouping of biological material, blood, body stains, and the examination of fibres and animal and plant tissues. But he was a competent general scientist, and his interests were wide, his scientific interests. Forensic biologists, particularly in the smaller laboratories, which this has been up to now,
become pretty versatile. But he wouldn't attempt to use the more sophisticated instruments in the instrument section, the mass spectrometer, for example. And you personally have no idea what he could have been doing?
None. I do know that he came into this office. I had to look up the name of a consultant surgeon who was giving evidence for the defence in one of our old cases, and I had the medical directory on my desk when I left last night. This morning it was back in its place in the library. Few things irritated Lorimer more than people removing books from the library. But if he was in this office last night, I hardly imagine it was merely to check on my carelessness with the reference books.
Lastly, Dalgliesh asked him about his movements the previous night.
I played the fiddle at the village concert. The rector had 5 minutes or so to fill in, and asked me if the string quartet would play something which he described as short and cheerful. The players were myself, a junior chemist, one of the scientific officers from the document examination department, and a typist from the general office. Miss Easterbrook should have been the first cello, but she had a dinner engagement, which she regarded as important, and couldn't make it. We played the Mozart Divertimento in D major, and came third on the programme.
And you stayed for the rest of the concert?
I intended to. Actually, the hall was incredibly stuffy. And just before the interval at 8:30, I slipped out. I stayed out.
Dalgliesh asked what precisely he'd done.
Nothing. I sat on one of those flat tombstones for about 20 minutes. Then I left.
Did you see anyone? Or did anyone see you?
I saw a hobby horse. I know now that it must have been Middlemouth deputising for Chief Inspector Martin. Come out of the male dressing room. He pranced around rather happily, I thought, and snapped his jaws at an angel on one of the graves. Then he was joined by a troupe of Morris dancers coming through the graveyard from the Moonraker. It was an extraordinary sight. There was the racing moon, and these extraordinary figures, with their bells jingling and their hats decked with evergreens, moving through the swirl of ground mist out of the darkness toward me. It was like an outre film or a ballet. All it needed was second-rate background music, preferably Stravinsky. I was sitting motionless on the gravestone some distance away, and I don't think they saw me. I certainly didn't make myself known. The hobby horse joined them, and they went into the hall. Then I heard the fiddle start up. I suppose I stayed sitting there for about another 10 minutes, and then I left. I walked for the rest of the evening along Leeming's Dyke, and got home about 10 o'clock. My half-sister, Domenica, will be able to confirm the time.
They spent a little time discussing the administrative arrangements for the investigation. Dr. Howarth said that he would move into Miss Foley's room and make his office available to the police. There would be no chance of the lab opening for the rest of the day, but Dalgliesh said that he hoped it would be possible for work to start again the next morning. Before Howarth left, Dalgliesh said, "Everyone I've spoken to respected Dr. Lorimer as a forensic biologist. But what was he like as a man? What, for example, did you know about him, except that he was a forensic biologist?" Dr. Howarth said coldly, "Nothing. I wasn't aware that there was anything to know, except that he was a forensic biologist. And now, if you've no more immediate questions, I must telephone Establishment Department and make sure that, in the excitement of his somewhat spectacular exit, they're not forgetting to send me a replacement."
This ends Disc 4.